Nationwide, we bring you latest current issues, discussions and information. Nationwide on Radio Miraya.
Yes, hello and welcome once again on Nationwide Discussion Hour on Radio Miraya. And I'm happy to say that my guest is now connected and we are going to be live on the program. And today we will be discussing the issue of accountability and commander responsibility when it comes to the transitional justice issues. And this is part of our regular weekly program in which we speak about issues of transitional justice. And my guest today is Yasmin Suka, Executive Director of the International Truth and Justice. Welcome, Yasmin Suka, on Radio Miraya's Nationwide program with me, Gabriel Shadar.
Hi, good evening, and thank you for having me.
Yes, welcome. Article 31st of the Commission for the Truth, Reconciliation and Healing Act states that the Commission shall grant amnesty to anyone who truthfully confesses and prevents or presents evidence except for crimes of genocide, crimes against humanity and war crimes for which no amnesty can be given. And amnesty is a legal protection that protects an individual or group from criminal prosecution for a crime that they have committed. In granting amnesty, the Commission will consider motive, the context in which the act was or crime took place, and whether the act was committed in response to a command or order. So, Yasmin Suka, today we have you on this very important issue. And let us start first by explaining, what does amnesty mean?
Thank you very much. But let me start off by saying that, you know, amnesties are considered to be very controversial. You know, and over decades, we have developed a normative framework. And you, in fact, have referred to the fact that even the Act acknowledges that there's a prohibition on amnesties for war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. But of course, amnesties have also come because of many practical reasons. Often, you know, people will argue that if you want to get the other side to lay down their arms, then you have to offer them some sort of deal. And of course, the challenge is that when you look at those who participate usually in the negotiations around ceasefires and the ending of a conflict and, of course, the resolution to peace, it's often those who hold political power. And they will argue that without some form of amnesty, armed actors may never lay down their weapons and conflicts will not end. For victims, of course, the fear is always that justice will be sacrificed for peace. And I think that this is the debate that South Sudan, of course, is now confronting. Many South Sudanese participated in the discussions around the Commission on Truth, Healing and Reconciliation in May 2024. And I think those who participated will remember that the first zero draft of the bill that was presented during the conference, which was convened by the government, it did not include a provision on amnesty. But there was an intervention at the conference, and this was by Stephen Kay, the lawyer who had represented the government and President Salva Kiir in other legal matters, including litigation. And he presented a number of recommendations, which he said aligned with the government's position. And of course, this included the introduction of an amnesty provision in the bill at that time. And so it wasn't surprising that when the subsequent draft bill was introduced in Parliament, that included Section 31, which mandated the Commission to actually grant amnesties. But this didn't go unopposed. And of course, the Transitional Justice Working Group opposed this, and they advocated for an amendment to Article 31. And what they said in their proposal was that if you go back to the peace agreement, the revitalized peace agreement, it adopted a clear position against amnesties for international crimes and, of course, also for serious crimes under the South Sudanese Penal Code, and that this principle should be maintained and explicitly stated in the legislation that was establishing the commission. And what they argued was that, in fact, instead of granting an amnesty, what the commission could do was recommend alternative sentencing for individuals who were found to be responsible for lesser offenses, but on no, there should be no amnesty allowed. Now, what an amnesty does, of course, is that an amnesty is a legal measure that, if granted, will protect an individual or group from criminal prosecution for certain acts of gross human rights violations or serious international crimes committed in the past. It is often used as a tool during transitions from conflict or from authoritarian rule to peace. And in fact, in my own country, South Africa, part of the negotiated settlement included a conditional amnesty for those who had committed gross human rights violations. And in effect, that meant that if granted, those who received it would not be prosecuted. And if they were in prison already, then, of course, they would be released. But, I think one of the sort of lessons or practical, issues that we've sort of had to grapple with is that we have to interpret justice and accountability in a much broader way. And that justice means that it's not just about retributive justice or punishment, but that it can also include an exchange of truth. It can include public acknowledgement, the recognition of the rights of victims and the violations that were perpetrated against them. It can include reparations, memorializations, and of course, institutional reform. But having said that, I would like to argue that one should always limit the use of amnesties. And the real question I think that we should ask is, how should amnesty be used? For what crimes? Who should benefit? And it should always form part of a broader system that delivers truth, justice, accountability, and dignity for victims. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you look at the case of South Sudan, the transitional justice framework that South Sudan has as a legacy arises from the revitalized peace agreement. And what this reflects is a broader approach to justice and accountability. And so when you look at the peace agreement, it envisages not just the setting up of a truth commission, but also a compensation and reparations authority and a hybrid court. And this, of course, the intention was that truth, reparations, and criminal accountability are meant to work together. And so we would need to be very careful to ensure that amnesty does not replace the intention of the mechanisms and can only operate within that framework. And of course, the African Union intended, actually, and those who drafted the peace agreement, that in fact, all three instruments should be set up together, because in a way, what they do is they balance the question of truth with the need for criminal accountability and for reparations. And so that I think is an important issue to take account of.
Yeah. Thanks, Yasmin, for this elaborate explanation. And the question is that from what you are saying, there are three mechanisms of justice that are mentioned. And there is that a risk? Are there risks that are involved that some of the demands might be compromised? And where does the balance lie in the commission? Is there a room for discussions among the members of the commission as to which way to go according to which case in this?
Yes, that's a very important question because, you know, when you look at the way in which amnesties have been dealt with in many countries, you know, of course, you know, the balancing really comes into setting down the kind of conditions that are required to actually balance this question of impunity with, in fact, the question of accountability. So in my country, for instance, you had a separate amnesty committee in the Truth Commission. So, you know, the commission was made up of three committees, the Truth, you know, Human Rights Violations Committee, an Amnesty Committee, and a Reparations and, you know, Rehabilitation Committee. And the Amnesty Committee was made up of judges. When you look at another example in the region, for instance, you had the commission, the Truth Commission, which in fact had to also consider whether it wanted to deal with this, and it chose not to. And then, of course, you had the Special Court for Sierra Leone, which was a hybrid court. And in fact, the court made it very clear that, you know, amnesties would never be permitted for these kinds of serious crimes. And so when you look at Section 31, it actually says that in considering the amnesty, the commissioners have to consider the question of motive, the question of context, and whether the act was committed pursuant to an order. But the law is also unequivocal because it draws a line and it says there can be no amnesty for genocide, war crimes, or crimes against humanity. And so, you know, the position, of course, internationally is very, very clear that, you know, superior orders are not a defense. And at most, you know, obedience to orders can be considered a question of mitigation, but only in very narrow circumstances. And so I do think that, you know, this is going to need to be looked at very carefully. Now, of course, in the context of South Sudan, you know, it talks about the sort of exchange of truth. But, you know, I think a better word to use is the question of full disclosure. And this is why, you know, where perpetrators, in fact, are going to be applying and where the commission has to consider it, one of the questions they will need to deal with is, what does full disclosure actually mean? And what does it mean if they have to tell the complete truth? Because this is not just an admission about the act, but what they will do is need to do is to explain what happened, who was involved, who gave the orders, what their own role was, what was the motive for the act or the crime they committed, who was responsible for the planning and preparation, what happened before, what happened afterwards, and was there any attempt to conceal the crime? Now, one, you know, in many of the examples around the world that have had to deal with the question of amnesty, they have repeatedly stressed that a partial disclosure or half-truth is not enough. So if an applicant minimized their role, or they withheld their names, or they concealed orders, or they denied the key facts which are later proven, or they tailored their version to the evidence, then, of course, amnesty must be refused. And so, in effect, a full disclosure means the whole truth. It's not just about admitting the act, but it's about revealing the chain of command, the motive, the planning, the consequences, and of course, the exchange of truth in exchange for the amnesty. And of course, what we have are many, many comparative examples, which I think South Sudan is going to take into account.
Yasmin Suka, as you were narrating the questions, I started to think about the sequencing. Where do we start? Do we start with the case and say, okay, this case must have some elements of war crimes or crimes against humanity and genocide, and then we look for the perpetrators? Or do we side the other way around? We ask people to come forward and confess, and then we decide whether what they are confessing in their truth-telling constitute any of these categories that I have mentioned.
It's a very interesting question. And in fact, I would say that in fact, the process should be twofold. You know, on the one hand, I think the commission itself will, in the course of its work, identify cases. And clearly they would need to investigate those cases and identify who the perpetrators may possibly be. And of course, they would probably have, a range of legal powers which would allow them to invite the perpetrators to come forward and in fact, make these confessions or full disclosures. On the other hand, I think a very important component of the work of the commission should also be to, in fact, establish a process in which perpetrators can come forward. And, I would argue that in terms of the best experiences in the continent, it would be much better if perpetrators made an application and they did so individually. And in those applications, they actually disclose the case that they are involved in and also all of the facts. And this would allow, I think, the commission then to kind of compare their own work in, determining which of the cases that they should be looking at, but also looking at these individual cases where people are applying for amnesty. And in fact, setting that out against each other to really triangulate, is a full disclosure being made? Is there a need to actually have a specific hearing? Because I think, all of these details are going to need to be worked out by the commission. And quite clearly, there will be different streams. On the one hand, you're going to have victims who will want to come before the commission, and they will want the commission to take up their case. And of course, what we have found from many countries that in a number of these kinds of cases, often the victims don't actually know who exactly the perpetrators are. And that is why it's also important to have this other stream which will allow for perpetrators and witnesses to come forward so that the commission will have at hand the best information that is out there. But it does mean that it's going to take an enormous amount of, planning to ensure that the commission can, of course, acquit itself and do the kind of work that is envisaged. And given that you have, almost three decades of conflict now in South Sudan, you can actually see that the commission is going to have its work cut out for it. And so the composition of the commission and, of course, the procedures it adopts, I think, is going to be a really important issue going forward.
Yeah. My last question before I go to the listeners is, Now, if we take examples like in Rwanda, the genocide was preceded by propaganda. You know what I'm saying? Including media. And now we have social media and all this, and which is we can put it to say incitement and hate speech and all these kind of things. And then you have, during the conflict itself, you have the actual players on the ground, those who might be carrying the guns, implementing orders. And then you have the commanders, and then you have leadership somewhere. So what is the spectrum? What does the spectrum cover? Does it cover all these categories I have been referring to?
Yeah, it does. And I think that, you know, social media has certainly played a really important role. And we have seen prosecution of people, in particularly media people. When you look at, I think it's France, who also indicted and convicted somebody who was in the media and who used the media as propaganda and as incitement and hate speech for, you know, egging people on in the conflict in Rwanda. I think what we're certainly going to see is a wide spectrum of people who, in fact, will be held accountable and responsible. But of course, we should remember that, you know, it's you have people who plan, right, these mass atrocity crimes. You have people who, in fact, tolerate that. You have people who encourage and incite. And then, of course, you have the leadership who, in fact, fail to stop these crimes. And I think in South Sudan, you know, we saw an example recently of a general who, in fact, told his soldiers that, in fact, they should leave no living thing alive, not a chicken, you know, not a house, not the elderly. And in fact, for that, he bears, you know, command responsibility, because I think that we always have to distinguish between the people who pull the trigger and who commit the crimes and the people who are responsible for having command and control of the troops who actually carry out these crimes. And so we need to make sure that that spectrum is covered. But then in addition to that, you know, we also have what we call superior responsibility. And those are people who may not perhaps be the generals in command, but they in fact may be the politicians, the ministers who are in charge and who actually know what is happening, or they ought to have known. And once they knew, they failed to prevent or to punish and to hold those who in fact carried out these crimes responsible. And so this is where the question of command responsibility becomes quite important, because the one thing we need to ensure is that, you know, the foot soldiers are not the only ones who bear responsibility. And amnesties particularly should never become a shield which can be used by those in command and, in fact, those who have political responsibility. And I think that is an important issue going forward.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Yasmin Suka. And now we open the lines for the listeners who would like to interact with you on this important issue, which we are discussing, amnesty, accountability and command responsibility when it comes to the transition of justice. And we have the Commission for Truth, Reconciliation and Healing that has been formed. And the calling numbers are 09-1206-7879 and 09-1206-7929 and 09-1206-8101. Let me pick the first caller here. Hello? Hello.
Yes, good evening, Governor Shadar, and greeting to Yasmin. This is Jaden from Upper Nile, Malakal.
Welcome, Jaden.
Okay, my first question is this. We have senior officials from both sides of the political divide who are currently sanctioned by international community and UN. But it looks like these guys, they are still enjoying their freedom. I'm wondering, how will the truth, healing and reconciliation get power to make sure that these guys are accountable for the crime that they have committed? That's one thing. Second thing is, where will the truth, healing and reconciliation get police to enforce some of its resolution and finding to make sure that these people are held accountable. And the last thing it is, right now, so we already have a case in court, and it looks like it's one-sided, and all the reports are pointing that both sides of the political divide have committed atrocities. So what will happen if the same system will still be in power? Don't you think the truth, healing, and reconciliation will be one-sided, because one side will have power and the other side will not have power? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jaden, for your question there. For those who still want to interact on this discussion, the numbers are 09-1206-7879, 09-1206-7929. Another caller here. Hello.
Gabriel Joseph Sirar.
Yes, welcome.
Yes, tamam, kira?
Tamam.
Okay. James Ndiami, Tomasovka.
Marhab, James.
Making commandant bonus the Maduro because social media.
Mm-hmm.
Allah social media hokwes yan bodina na malumad hamil o barmarat sina tanin ma bodi malumad kwes social media usajal hajad al ma bodi al community kidam o sina tanin kaman yan uman mutabi I hajab social media al kalama la hajiga al urshunu ashanazal usajal hajad barmarat social media al masa.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Shukran, James Mbia. And we are keeping more calls with my guest online, Yasmin Suka, Executive Director of International Truth and Justice. And for those who would like to call, please, and you can send your SMS on 0912-177-141. Hello?
Good evening.
Good evening.
David McGill from WOW.
Welcome, David.
Your guests, we have heard the explanation that she did nicely, but we are still having some questions to her. Number
mm-hmm.
one,
mm-hmm.
The justice that she's talking about.
We've lost our caller, David Magog. Okay, you can try on the other lines, 09-1206-7879 and 09-1206-7929, so that we can get you. Hello?
Hello, Mirror.
Yes, welcome. Yes.
Hello, my name is Jack.
Come again?
Makwei
Ajak.
Obach Ajak.
Obach Ajak. Calling from where?
Calling in POC now.
POC. Juba, Malakal, where?
Malakal now.
Malakal, okay. Tell us.
So you are talking about the justice?
Yes, we are talking about amnesty and accountability and command responsibility. Yes. Did you follow from the beginning? We've lost the caller there. He has not been following us. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, welcome.
Yes, I'm good.
Yes, welcome. Who's calling?
Good evening.
Good evening.
David, look up from Lumbeck.
David, welcome, David.
How are you doing, my brother?
I'm fine.
Okay. I appreciate you, the topic you brought today, my brother. It's a good topic.
Mm-hmm. We've lost David again from Rumbek. I don't know, it's a congestion on the lines, but still we are having this discussion with Yasmin Suka. And this is about amnesty, accountability, and command responsibility. We have lost the call. Yasmin, if you are there, it's time for you to respond to some of the questions raised by Jaden and the second caller also. Yes, welcome.
Thank you, Gabriel. You know, it's a very interesting question. And this goes, I think, to... in my initial brief, I said that we should, when we think about the transitional justice framework for South Sudan, the African Union and the international community envisage that you would have three institutions that would be set up: the Commission on Truth, Healing, and Reconciliation, the Reparations and Compensation Authority, and, of course, the hybrid court. And the intention of the hybrid court, of course, is to ensure that those who, in fact, have the greatest responsibility for the crimes which have been committed in South Sudan during the conflict, that the court, in fact, will have to deal with them. Now, of course, when we look at the examples of courts around the world, they don't really deal with more than 20 or 30 people. And that means that the commission is going to have to deal also with a great deal of these perpetrators. And it raises questions about the commission's legal powers. You know, we've always said that for a commission to be effective, a commission will need to have the power of search and seizure. In other words, it will need to be able to get access to documents. Secondly, it will need to have the power of subpoena, and it will need to have the power of investigation as well. And one of the questions, I think, which the caller raised was, how will the commission hold these people accountable? And of course, will they have their own police? Now, in most countries, of course, a commission has an independent team of investigators and an independent group of people who do the documentation. But it also has a legal team who, in fact, deal with the implementation of its powers. And so one way, one test for the commission is going to be the question of issuing subpoenas to ensure that the powerful, particularly, I think senior officials who tend not to want to be held accountable, how is it going to do that? And I think a question of police in a country where I think you really have a real, gap around that, that is going to be, quite critical in terms of implementation going forward. But, this is an interesting question, because when you look at the comparative examples around the world, including in the region, even though people have been incredibly powerful, you've also seen that presidents, you've seen that senior ministers, they've all had to go to a particular commission, or in some instances have also had to appear before the court. And so when we look at the powers of the commission, one of the things we're going to have to look at is, what is the question of sanction? What powers will the commission have in terms of dealing with people who initially may refuse to come? And so I think the question of process, the question of legal powers, the question of procedures, I think that is going to be an important consideration for the commission going forward. And that does also speak to the question of the caliber of the commissioners. Can they act without fear or favor? The second is the question of resources. And the third is the commitment by the international community and the region, IGAD, the African Union, to make sure that the commission can indeed act independently, because that will determine really the success of the commission in carrying this work forward.
Mm-hmm. This seems to be a very complicated, and as we move on with the implementation, we are facing a lot of questions that will need sincere discussions and deliberations from the parties to implement that. Now, let us see what are the chances and whether these efforts are going to be smooth in any way in the case of South Sudan.
I'm very hopeful that it will be. Look, let me say that, in no country is the role that is played by a commission like this always going to be smooth. It's a very political instrument. And in fact, it's going to run, into a lot of hiccups, particularly when it deals with politicians and when it deals with perpetrators. And then, of course, dealing with victims will require a special kind of skill, because the commission is also going to have to think about the question of how does it ensure that it's victim-centered, and how does it ensure that if there are applications or considerations of amnesty that the voices of victims are taken into account. So that's going to mean that, the people who are appointed to the commission need to be seen as credible. They need to be seen as particularly independent. And of course, in South Sudan, you're going to have a mixture of both people who come from South Sudan, and you're going to have a number of internationals. I, for instance, served as one of three international commissioners on the Truth Commission in Sierra Leone. And I think that, what we bring is a blend which allows the commission to act independently. But it's never all smooth sailing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the way in which it's going to run is going to depend on this initial period when it begins to work out how it is going to function, what its responsibilities are going to be, and how it's going to actually reach out to South Sudanese. Now, when you consider, South Sudan had an incredibly successful national dialogue process many, many years ago, and that commission actually traveled the length and breadth of the country. And surprisingly, people were not fearful of coming out to speak to the National Dialogue Commission and, in fact, to express their views. And one knows that the recommendations that, in fact, were made to the president were very strong indeed. And so if the commission, I think, can endeavor to reach out to South Sudanese, both in the country and those who are out in refugee camps and in the diaspora, I think that can play an important role in ensuring that the work of the commission is credible.
Yes, and then my last question, where I'm left with just 1 minute or a half, is the sequencing of the process, because now we are seeing a tendency to delink the democratization, the democratic process of election and all this from these demands. So they are going to be put afterward. This is the tendency at the moment. What's your quick comment on this?
I think that would not be very useful for South Sudan going forward. I think it's really important when you look at the revitalized peace agreement, those who in fact drafted the peace agreement envisaged that the democratic processes would take place, and that together with it, you would see these three transitional justice instruments set up and established. And going to elections without having them in place, I think, could be quite a risk for South Sudan. And the one thing we don't want to see is an escalation in conflict, which I think you're seeing already in many different parts of the country. And so really important to bring people back to the sense of where the process ought to be. And in fact, to ensure that civil society is engaged in the process of democratization, because the Truth Commission, the Hybrid Court, and the Reparations Commission are important elements of building a human rights culture and, in fact, democratizing South Sudan as well.
Thank you very much, Yasmin Suka, Executive Director of the International Truth and Justice Body. And we have been discussing amnesty, accountability, and command responsibility when it comes to the work of the Commission for Truth, Reconciliation, and Healing in South Sudan. Thank you very much for us, and we hope to hear from you again.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, and with that, I've come to the end of today's Nationwide Discussion Hour on Radio Miraya with me, Gabriel Shadar. Thanks for listening.
Nationwide, your daily current affairs program on Radio Miraya.